Hello and welcome to Popcorn Mumbles, where we dig into the back catalog, select a film or television show to rewatch. I'm Cody Nestor. He's Todd Hill.
Hey, guys.
This week, we've chosen the 2011 film Rise of the Planet of the Apes. Will Rodman, a scientist in San Francisco, is experimenting with a drug that he hopes will cure his father's Alzheimer's disease. After his work is deemed a failure, Will becomes the guardian of Caesar, an infant chimp who was exposed in utero to Will's drug. Caesar displays unusual intelligence, and Will decides to continue his experiment secretly, but as Caesar's intellect and abilities grow, he comes to represent a threat to man's dominion over Earth. Rise of the Planet of the Apes was released on August 5th, 2011. On a budget of $93 million, it made $470 million. It has a Rotten Tomatoes score of 82% and an audience score of 77%. So, Todd, let's discuss Rise of the Planet of the Apes. Spoilers are ahead.
Okay.
So, Todd, first question here, new kind of film franchise for us. We haven't touched on any of the Planet of the Apes films before. What's your history with the Apes films?
I go back all the way to the OG. I think that was, I don't remember the exact.
You mean Tim Burton?
No. I'm talking Charlton Heston, man. Okay. Stinking paws off me, Charlton Heston. I don't remember the exact. I know it was the late 60s.
68.
Yeah, 68. Yeah, I've always thought this was kind of a real ingenious sci-fi turn. I know there was a few sequels to the original. I think I saw a couple of those. I can be honest, I haven't saw them all.
Yeah, there was a lot. Yeah. Beneath.
Yeah, Conquest.
Of the Apes, Return. Yeah, there was a lot of sequels to that.
And then, as you mentioned, there was a Tim Burton effort that we may discuss here shortly in the future.
Yes.
And then we come here, which right out of the gate, I think is a fresh take and a nice start.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I've always been a big fan of the original Planet of the Apes. Again, I'm not going to sit here and say I've seen most of the sequels just when I caught them on TV back in the day, just bits and pieces here and there. A lot of them seem to focus on Roddy McDowell.
Right, Roddy McDowell.
Yeah, and what was his character's name?
Cornelius,
yes. Girl's name?
Zira.
Zira, yes. A lot of them focused on those characters, it seemed. But yeah, the OG original 1968 Charlton Heston Planet of the Apes is a science fiction classic.
Oh, and yeah.
In my opinion, hopefully we'll kind of cover it one day, you know, what hasn't been said. It's one of those films like what hasn't been said about, you know, Planet of the Apes.
Yeah, it's well-tread territory. Yeah,
yeah, exactly.
That's because it's so good.
Exactly. Yeah, this was a franchise now. I mean, this again started in 2011. We've got, this is directed by Rupert Wyatt. The other two sequels, you know, kind of which we'll probably hint at, but I think this is a solid start to this new trilogy. But to me, it really picks up in Dawn.
Right.
Rupert Wyatt comes in for this one, but the other two films were directed by Matt Reeves.
Reeves really ramps her up.
Yeah.
Ramps
it up. But, I mean, this is still a solid start. Yeah. There's a few problems I have with it, but this is still kind of a solid start overall. And if you've never seen this film, I would say kind of pause this video, kind of come back to us. I would say watch this, watch Dawn, and watch War of the Planet of the Apes. Like, watch this trilogy and kind of come back. We're going to be covering all three of those as we go forward. And we're also going to be seeing the new Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes as well.
Nice.
And let's talk. I kind of mentioned maybe going back to the Tim Burton one.
Yikes. I'm just kidding.
Exactly. I don't think I've watched that film since we saw it in the theaters back in 2001.
I think I'm right there with you.
Yeah.
I think that's a one-timer, so I'll have to really remember that.
That may have been the worst thing that happened in 2001.
Come on, man. You can't put that on Tim Burton. You ain't laying that shit at his feet, are you?
Okay. Let's get into the story, Todd. So, again, we go back to 2011. This was the time when Hollywood was still trying to make James Franco a leading man.
Yes,
believe
they
it
were.
Or not. Yes, unsuccessfully, I might add. And thankfully,
yeah.
I might add. yes, this is before his sex pestery was revealed to the world as well. But we kind of go back. It kind of ramps up and starts right off, you know, the first kind of part we see some kind of local, you know, kind of, I guess, rustlers. What's the word I'm looking for?
Kind of poachers, maybe
poachers,
rustlers.
Yes.
Yeah.
Capturing some chimps out in the wild. Then we go to our kind of a eureka moment with Franco, as we kind of see he is, again, as we kind of set up in the synopsis, he's kind of a scientist. He works for a company called Genesis, which reminds me of Terminator Genesis for some reason when I went back to kind of watch this. He's working for Genesis, and as mentioned before, his father is John Lithgow, and he is suffering from Alzheimer's. So he's a scientist, and he's researching a kind of a cure for that, which they think they have a cure in a drug called ALZ-112. And so it's stated it's a cure for Alzheimer's with no side effects, but, of course, has lots of side effects.
Lots of side effects.
Lots of side effects, of course. We're introduced to the first experimental chip, chimp number 9, Bright Eyes.
Bright Eyes.
Which is, of course, a reference back to 1968 when it was Mira that referred to Charlton Heston as Bright Eyes.
Bright Eyes, yeah.
So we go at the start of the film. The chimp it gets introduced. It gets injected with ALZ-112. It goes haywire. Of
haywire.
Course, you think it's because of the drug. After crashing into the Profits Above All Else meeting that was being held, we see Bright Eyes is kind of shot by security.
Yeah.
And then we see the guy who there's a. What does he say? I run a business, not a petting zoo guy. That's the, our greed is good, Gordon Gekko.
Oh, yeah.
I think his name is Jacobs. He's our,
yes, Jacobs.
He's our guy that runs Genesis. He's our profits over people kind of guy. He tells the chimp handler to kind of destroy all the test chimps. And we learn that Bright Eyes was actually aggressive because she was pregnant.
She had given birth.
So here's one of those little things. So you're telling me no scientist nor the chimp handler, anybody in that lab.
Knew she was pregnant.
Yeah, decided to run maybe any blood test or do any kind of testing to see if Bright Eyes may have been pregnant after bringing her in, Todd. That's my first little nitpick of the film.
Yeah.
But again, we go back to John Lithgow. He Franco kind of goes home. He's got little Caesar with him. He got little Caesar in his arms. And we kind of cut to 3 years later. You kind of see Caesar's kind of becoming highly intelligent compared to, I think Franco says, compared to a human counterpart of the same age.
Right.
And then Franco goes back and steals 3 vials of the ALZ-112 to kind of give to John Lithgow. And then you start kind of seeing little C's at Caesar. He kind of wants to be free. He spends a lot of time in the house kind of looking out that that window.
That kind of attic window, yeah.
Yeah, you got to kind of see that he's kind of got a longing to kind of get out of the house and kind of be free. And he does get free one day, Todd. He does decide to go outside one day. What happens when he goes outside the first day by himself there?
I think that first day he winds up over in that neighbor's yard, and he kind of scares their daughter, and the father comes out and just way overreacts. Of course, it's a chimpanzee loose.
Yeah,
right there near your daughter. I guess I can understand it.
Yeah, a chimpanzee shows up in your neighborhood. I might understand a little startled.
So they have to come over and escort Caesar back and, you know, take him back over.
And he gets a little injury of some
sort. That's right. Does he hit him with something?
I don't know if he hits him or if he just scrapes himself, maybe going up that fence or something.
But maybe that was it, yeah.
Franco ends up taking him to the vet after he got harassed by the neighbor. So the vet's name is Caroline. So Franco, Lithgow, Caroline, they all kind of take Caesar to the Redwoods for some fresh air after they kind of develop their relationship. And you see kind of Franco ask her out, and she kind of learns about Caesar and how smart he is. And he's kind of signing back and forth with Franco. And then we kind of get a great montage of Caesar kind of growing up as we kind of swing in and going through and jumping from tree to tree. It's very Tarzan, very Disney Tarzan.
Yeah. I really liked that part where they're still back at the Redwood Forest, and they come up on that couple with a dog, and the dog's on a leash, and Caesar's on a leash, and he kind of signs, you know, am I a pet? Mm-hmm. Am I a pet to you?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's a really great scene. Again, it's kind of sowing those seeds. He sees that family, like, kind of leading their dog, and he asks Franco, you know, am I a pet? And I love that he doesn't want to get in the back hatch of their little, like, SUV
anymore.
Yeah,
he wants to get in like a human now.
Yeah. I read that Andy Serkis, obviously, we should mention him. He plays Caesar here, motion capture, work as Caesar.
Awesome stuff,
He's the granddaddy of motion capture. Yeah. He cemented that with Gollum and the Lord of the Rings franchise and kind of keeps solidifying that here and his work on these three films. But apparently he ad-libbed that scene of Caesar not refusing to get in the back and getting into kind of the back seat like a normal person would. Really great scene, really kind of great setup and kind of characterization, kind of seeing the wheels kind of turning with Caesar and kind of his his role within the family and his role in humanity, really.
Yeah.
And his role, as the character, we'll kind of see him kind of evolve into. But Lithgow, he had been doing good. The ALZ-112 was working wonders. He'd kind of gotten his life back. We kind of see that it's slowly kind of returning.
Yeah, his body's kind of making antibodies, kind of fighting against it.
Yeah.
I think he says it's going to come back worse than ever.
Worse than ever, yeah. So he actually, a lot of times in the movie, he's been looking for his car keys. He's real keen to drive.
Right.
You want to talk about what happens when he takes a drive in the neighbor's car,
so
Todd?
He goes out and gets in the neighbor's Mustang thinking it's his car, and he just proceeds to back it into one in front of him, back it into one behind him, one in front, one behind. And the neighbor comes out, and he's all like up in it, you know, what are you doing in my car? And I think he's trying to pull him out or get him out. And
he's like poking him in the chest.
And Caesar's seeing this from that little attic window, and he thinks he's hurting him, and that's it. Caesar's outside. Does he bite that guy's finger off? He bites that guy's finger completely.
Not off.
But he bites him on the hand. Yeah. He draws blood, definitely.
Yeah, he's like a Costin Lithgow, and he starts he gives out, and Caesar jumps him and starts pummeling him. And he bites his finger. I actually read, too, in some of the research I did, they debated having him bite his finger completely off, and Rupert Wyatt thought that it would kind of turn people against Caesar a little bit if he bit his whole ass finger off, you know. So, yeah, he just kind of accosts him and stuff. So from that, of course, after he's been loose in the neighborhood, now he's attacked a neighbor.
Now he's attacked a neighbor and bit a guy.
Yeah, so the animal control, of course, is called, and he's kind of taken to what we'll call Brian Cox's House of Animal Horrors.
Think it's a nice place, but it's not.
You look like he's got this nice little habitat and stuff where they can kind of roam around and kind of have a little bit of room, but then they're just immediately kind of shuttled into their cages by Draco Malfoy. God, I hate that guy. Just his little face. Just remembering it from the Harry Potter franchise. Just enough for me to instantly hate him. Nonetheless, he's also a cruel piece of shit to animals.
Right.
And cruel to Caesar and all the other chimps and apes that are in there. But yeah, they call animal control, and he's kind of having to surrender kind of right away. He has to surrender Caesar to him and kind of let him stay there. I like to, again, it's kind of set up as soon as like Caesar kind of gets there, all the other apes kind of start going crazy. Mm-hmm. They kind of see him as something different.
Yeah.
It's kind of riling them up too. They kind of mention, cause like Caesar's wearing like clothes, and it's kind of, that's something that kind of riles up the other apes and stuff in captivity. He's like, he's wearing his little sweater and his slacks.
Yeah. There's that one that he goes out there in that little play area, and there's that one, you assume he's like the king of the yard.
Yeah,
so
he's
far.
The alpha.
Yeah. You don't hear the dialogue, but he's like, hey man, this is my yard.
Yeah, so with a fucking sweater.
Yeah, he rips that sweater off of him. You ain't wearing no damn sweater here in my yard, boy.
Yeah, we definitely, you get the setup of the hierarchy and the pecking order setup, and that alpha definitely kind of shows that he is the alpha in that kind of group to Caesar.
For now,
We cut back to Franco, and he's trying to convince capitalism in a suit to allow him to test more of a more aggressive strain of the ALZ-112 he said he's created.
Bump on up to the 113.
Yeah, to the 113 on some chips. So he, of course, profits over people, profits over everything. He agrees to kind of let him do some testing of his new 113 compound. Back at Ape Hell, Caesar and the other apes are kind of being tortured by Draco Malfoy, of course.
That bastard.
Yeah. Caesar kind of uses it's kind of sad. Caesar uses that rock to kind of draw on the window.
That window.
A window that he used to look out on his wall. Just kind of, you know, sad animal, tragic, just stuff that you hate to kind of see there. And then we get Franco back at Jensis. Franco in the audience for the first time is introduced to Koba.
Oh, yes.
And Koba will definitely come
in. Koba will be a major player later on.
Yeah,
folks.
Definitely. Yeah. Definitely Koba will come back into play in this film and also in Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, which I think Koba is even more of a factor in Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. But yeah, we'll definitely be seeing more of him kind of soon. But they give Koba's the one they give the aerosolized version of the 113. So during that procedure, you see Koba kind of thrash around. He ends up knocking the mask off the chimp handler, and he ends up like kind of disconnecting the tube that's putting out the aerosolized
version. It's aerosol now, so that guy inhales some of it.
Yeah, he takes a deep lung full of the OALZ-113, so you know that's going to go somewhere. But you mentioned before, back in Ape Hell, Caesar and the Alpha. So he's kind of set up and kind of been challenged by that Alpha. And then as you kind of see the wheels again turning about when we kind of go back to Caesar about plotting kind of ways that he may be able to kind of subvert that Alpha. And one of the ways that he kind of goes about subverting that is he doesn't do it with brute force from himself. He does it with his intelligence, which is to kind of maybe – see if he can get a new ally, which we'll kind of come to in just a little bit. But maybe a gorilla on his side would help him out in the fight against the alpha.
Help.
Yeah. We see Koba. He's kind of becoming extremely intelligent. There's that great little scene where Jacobs kind of visits him, and he like writes Jacob's name.
Yeah.
And just the look of Koba is just amazing.
He's menacing.
I can't remember what genus of Simeon he is, bonobo maybe, something like that. I think I might be butchering that, but I think it's like they said it was like the first time that genus had ever been in like a Planet of the Apes film.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's bonobo is what his actual genus actually is. Do you want to set up what's going on with the chimp handler after he took some aerosolized 113, Todd?
So was it back where I think he kind of brings some of his friends? Oh, the chimp handler, my bad.
Yeah,
the chimp handler is he's starting to show some symptoms. He's sneezing and coughing blood. Not good.
Not good. I think at one point he goes to Franco's house and he's kind of sneezing and coughing.
He's blood. Trying to let him know he's showing, hey, I got some symptoms of this shit.
I got some symptoms. Yeah, we'll call him at this point. He goes from chimp handler to patient zero.
Yes.
He's looking for Franco. And he sneezes on his neighbor.
Yeah, sneezes on the.
That poor neighbor, you think about it. His family's done been scared by a chimp. His car was wrecked by John Lithgow. He's been pummeled by Caesar. And now his finger's been bitten. And now blood's been coughed in his face.
And now he's victim number two.
He's victim number two. Exactly. And it's kind of mentioned. We'll kind of keep it in the back of your mind. He mentioned a couple times. We'll see it at the end. But it's mentioned before that when he's in that little scene with Lithgow crashing his car, that he needs to. He's a pilot and he's like late getting to the airport and stuff.
Just keep
that filed away as well. We meet Maurice back at Ape Hill.
Orangutan.
Yeah, yeah. Orangutan Maurice. I have a little note about that. Let me jump to that real quick. So do you know why his name is Maurice, what that's a reference to?
That was in reference to, I think, the actor that played the original orangutan in the 60s Planet of the Apes.
Yes, that's a reference to Maurice Evans, who played Dr. Zaius in the original Planet of the Apes movies. But he shows Caesar that he can sign as well. And so they kind of have a little bit of a communication back and forth. And I love the scene where Caesar tells him apes alone weak, apes together strong. And he like kind of demonstrates it with those sticks, like kind of cracking one, cracking two.
But when he got them all together, he can't break them.
Exactly. Yeah. And he sees like some of the other behavior, some of the other chimps and apes in the room, Maurice does. And Maurice is like, apes stupid. Apes dumb.
Apes dumb,
yeah. But yeah, you kind of get development, and Maurice is another character that will kind of factor in heavily to the kind of sequels that you kind of get going forward.
So I think somewhere around that time is where old Malfoy brings in like a couple of girls and his buddy.
Oh yeah, he brings in them sluts, yeah.
And one of them gets a little bit too close to Caesar. Caesar kind of gets him in a little bit of a bear hug, holding him in there close to his cage, but he lets him go, and he lifted his pocket knife off the guy.
Yeah, he lifts that pocket knife off of this. Oh, we also forgot to mention, too, Caesar, it does come back. Caesar does befriend the gorilla that's kind of been in close. He's kind of separated from all the others.
Yeah.
He uses that gorilla, kind of befriends him with a bag of Chips Ahoy cookies.
Yeah.
And he uses him to kind of assert dominance over the alpha, the original alpha. And he uses the alpha to kind of start giving treats out, those Chips Ahoy cookies all the others. But, yeah, Malfoy and them kind of bring the sluts in there and, Caesar kind of lifts that knife off of his dumb friend. But yeah, and then he uses that gorilla kind of shirt to his dominance and the pecking order.
Yeah, then eventually he gets completely out of the compound, Caesar does, and he goes back to his old house and he lifts some of those 113 that's still in the refrigerator.
Yeah, exactly.
Three canisters of that stuff.
We also lose Lithgow. There's one point where Franco is at his bedside. He's going to kind of give him some of the aerosolized 113.
He doesn't know, yeah.
And non-verbally kind of communicates to him. He's like, no more. It's my time.
Yeah.
And that's when Franco, he goes back to work and, Greed is a good guy. He's amping up testing on more chimps. And then this is where Franco's character does kind of like a 180. Like now he's the one worried about results and the virus's impact on humans.
Yeah.
Like the human-related effects. Like he's the one that doesn't want to kind of proceed with testing until they have a better understanding of what they're dealing with. So he kind of does. Where was that kind of worry when you were injecting your father with this experimental drug?
At the beginning, he's like, we're ready. Human trials. Let's go.
Yeah, I'm just going to dump this into my father's veins. What's the worst that could happen, So, yeah. And then he quits. He quits Genesis, of course. And then we mentioned back at his house that chimp handler's kind of been working, looking for him. The resolution of him, his neighbor Dottie, I think she says that's her name. She ends up finding him dead in his apartment.
Dead, yeah.
Yeah, so he's our first victim of what we'll call the ape virus. And then Franco goes back and he bribes William Stryker to let Caesar go. And I'm like, why didn't you just do that immediately?
Yeah, why didn't you do that when you had to take him there to start with? Here's an envelope full of money. Do you really have to keep Caesar?
Yeah.
Not, do you?
Yeah, when you got any kind of vibe, and I mean that, you know, Brian Cox and all his guys are give off a vibe of they're not all on the up and up anyway.
Yeah.
Once you kind of got a whiff of that vibe, why didn't you go back there with an envelope full of money and be like, hey, can I have my chimp back? Oh, yeah, okay. But yeah, we don't do that immediately. But he tries to get Caesar back with bribing Brian Cox to let him go. Caesar refuses to leave. At this point, he's got some other things on his mind about what to do at that point.
And, was it at that point, or was it another visit where he just kind of like, they ain't getting me out of here, and he just kind of wipes that little wind that he made off the wall?
I think that's another visit that they made.
I think it was the second one. He was like, you're not going home now either, too, buddy.
Yeah, he wipes. And that's when everything kind of got set in motion. Like, he knows,
that's
like,
what set him off.
He's not going home, and so like he's got to make the best of it. And with his extreme intelligence, he's
planning. Pretty damn good.
Yeah, he's plotting and planning, and then the ape uprising slowly begins. We see Rocket for the first time. That's another one of the apes that'll kind of factor into the further sequels. Mm-hmm. And then you mentioned Caesar kind of escapes that habitat, goes back and gets that 113 and comes back and disperses it amongst all the other, because as Maurice said, apes dumb. So Caesar has to fix that, make apes smart. And he disperses that amongst all the apes, and then he ends up through the course of events there at Ape Hell. Do you want to tell what happens to Draco and his brother, I guess?
I think the brother was kind of the nicer of the two, and they just kind of drag him in a cell and leave him. But
they beat him a little bit, but
they
Caesar's
beat him
like,
up, but they leave him. Draco, however,
yeah.
And there's that one point where Caesar puts his hands on him, and he's like, "Take your stinking paws off me, you damn dirty ape."
That's the thing. I'm like, you don't need that. Yeah. That's a nitpick I have. To give it to Draco Malfoy to say too, and like, I think that was a little too wink, wink, nod, nod. I don't think you needed that.
That was the way over the top obvious one. Yeah.
Yeah, it really was.
That's the first time Caesar speaks, because he's like, "No."
Yeah, exactly. He ends up spraying. What does he do to Malfoy? Malfoy ends up, because he's got that cattle prod.
Oh yeah, then he sprays him with the hose and that electrocutes
him. He's freakazed there. He's freakazed there, and that's where the apes at that point they're just loose in the city.
They're busted out, and it's apes in the city, baby.
It's apes in the city, and this is where you get like some of the strongest stuff. Obviously, we're kind of setting up what's going to go on and what's happening here, but this is where you kind of get some of the strongest stuff. Like, there's that part where all the apes are running on top of the trees in in the city down that neighborhood, and all the leaves are kind of falling.
Almost like snow or debris.
Yeah, that's like a really, really, really great kind of shot there. And you see not only Caesar releases the one from the ape habitat, Caesar also goes to the zoo. They release all the chimps from the zoo. Also like the part where like the gorilla kind of knocks over the cage that they're kind of kept in. And later on, it's like kind of a good bit where like they're using the kind of metal rods from those gates as like spears.
Yeah, yeah.
Like that's another like little touch. They also go and liberate all the apes from Genesis as well. So not only is he's not just worried about the apes that are like nearest to him, like the ones in the habitat.
He wants them all free.
He's liberating like all of the apes. And then, you know, apes loops in San Francisco and like all the Golden Gate Bridge scenes, like all of that stuff is like the strongest kind of parts of the film. So like, you want to take us through like the bridge scene a little bit, like how we get to the bridge scene and what goes on there.
So basically, the police are alerted by now. They've got cops en route. They're trying to block off the bridge. We've got the old McBuck Jacobs guy up in a chopper. He's flying overhead. You know, he's like, shoot him, kill him all.
You got to destroy all
of them. You got to destroy all of them. And so the apes kind of take this tact of they see their way blocked behind them and the way is blocked in front of them. So they go on top and they go underneath and they get to exactly where they need to be.
It's like some good details there. Like, they know it's just going to be like a shooting gallery. Mm-hmm. So there's like at one point where like all of them are kind of pushing a bus and using that as kind of cover.
Yeah.
And like, that's like some really good setup and stuff. There's a point where the gorilla is like, they send in some mounted policemen, and the gorilla is about to kind of pummel to death one of the mounted policemen, and Caesar's like, no, don't kill him.
Yeah.
And then 5 minutes later, he throws a cop out of the car and off the bridge. That guy's so fucking dead. Like, I literally researched it. I was like, does a fall from the San Francisco Golden Gate Bridge, will it kill you?
Yes.
And apparently he has about a 5% chance of survival, and he's hitting the water no matter what, about 75 miles an hour, because it's about a 4 second fall.
And I think that guy's gone. And the big gorilla actually jumps up and takes out the helicopter, but he gets a few rounds in the chest.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Yeah. You can actually see like him being shot while he's in the air, just like a really good detail. But yeah, the crashing of the chopper and him getting shot in midair, like all that stuff is like great.
Yeah, the entire whole bridge sequence is awesome.
I think they said they built like a 400-foot long set for that, which is like the biggest at the time, like the biggest set ever created. And like you see a lot of work and effort went into that, and like all the bridge stuff was really, really done and really handled very well. And then, of course, the chopper crashes, and Jacobs is still alive. And who gets to finish him off? Koba. Koba is the one that goes up to the chopper and just gives it the slight little nudge.
Kick off the side.
On over. At this point, Franco's shown up on the bridge. The vet, Caroline, has kind of caused a distraction. He's able to kind of get close enough to Caesar to at least yell his name, and Caesar kind of recognize him and see him.
Because he kind of deduced where Caesar's going. He's heading back to that redwood forest.
He's heading back to the redwoods, and so he kind of trails Caesar and the rest of the apes there in a cop car he's taken, and he meets with Caesar in the redwoods, and he's begging Caesar, come home with me. I'll protect you. And you get that great moment, that great line. Caesar kind of embraces him and whispers in his ear. He says, "Caesar is home."
Yeah.
And then you're kind of the last kind of film ends with the apes kind of climbing high up into the redwoods and kind of looking back at the city. You kind of see some of the city that's been left pristine. You see some of the chaos and kind of the stuff that's going on the bridge. It's just like a great kind of final kind of shot to kind of end on here. We do get a mid-credits scene. As I mentioned before, our pilot neighbor, we see him, the pilot neighbor who got coughed on by Patient Zero. He's a pilot. He arrives at the airport, and we hint to him about the Typhoid Mary, the virus around the world. And you kind of see it in the end credits, kind of the spread of what will come to be known as the kind of the ape virus, I guess. And we'll see definitely more of that as we go forward into Dawn of the Planet of the Apes and War for the Planet of the Apes. But I mean, what's your thoughts here, Todd? What do you think about this film overall? What you like, what you didn't like?
Just to touch on the virus portion, I was thinking about this last night when I was watching. I was like, you know, I wonder how this kind of plays now, like in a post-COVID world.
So I have a note about that as well. Mine is not so much how it plays. After the pandemic, I find this film even more frightening.
Right.
Because you can debate how COVID was handled from like a rational standpoint and of course like a political one, but the fact that a virus with a relatively high mortality rate for the most vulnerable of our population was going around, and we had an unsettling number of people kind of viewed it as a government hoax.
Yeah.
That tells me that if we dealt with a fictional ape virus with a very way higher mortality rate, we're fucked. And that tells me that if we deal with a real world pandemic with a higher mortality rate in real life, we're fucked.
Right.
You know what I mean? So like COVID really, this watching this movie after COVID really puts it into perspective of just how fucked we are as a species when half of the population of the country is like, oh, that COVID is a government hoax. Whatever your feelings about COVID and how it was handled and all that. But I mean, yeah. It's pretty frightening after dealing with COVID. So that was my perspective. Well, not so much posing it to COVID. It's just like I feel for this our race,
right.
When we can't take that seriously. And this ape virus, if this were really this fictional virus was real, it would decimate us just as it does in this universe, as we see when we get to the third film.
Right.
What else did you like?
As far as the actual movie, I thought this was, you know, a great kind of reimagining of the original Planet of the Apes. You know, in the original, it's more of, you know, spoiler alert if you haven't seen a movie that came out in the 60s. But, you know, that was more of, you know, mankind out of control. We blew ourselves up. You know, we killed our own, self, and that's how the apes took over the planet. But
right.
This is more of, you know, virus is going to play into this. It's going to thin our herd. They're going to come. The apes are going to come to power. Mm-hmm. I think it's a strong start. I thought it was a, you know, like you say, it's got its nitpicks. It's not perfect, but right. It's a strong start.
Yeah, and I mean, it is nice that they went in a different direction. It wasn't just a straight out and out remake of Planet of the Apes. It did, like, again, as you said before, we were the cause of our own destruction. Mm-hmm. In this, we'll kind of come to see it. We still are the cause of our own destruction, but like we see the kind of apes rise up to power,
yeah,
and kind of the evolution of that, so to speak, as we kind of go along through the films. For me, I like a lot of it. I really like a lot of this film, you know, from the story. We should mention the effects are great. Yes. I mean, they're not quite on the level of the sequels. I mean, like, but I mean, like, they're right there. I mean,
yeah.
It's not night and day. It's like, you know, yeah. it's like dusk, and you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But it's the effects are strong. Again, the motion capture performance by Andy Serkis and his team, like all that stuff is like tremendous. There's not an effect in the movie I'm like, ugh.
Yeah, there's nothing cringe effect wise at
no,
all.
No, it's all kind of solid. Again, we've said Andy Serkis kind of cemented himself as like the king of motion capture. And it's not only just his motion capture performance, like it's his performance and his physicality as Caesar that really carries the film and the sequels that yeah. we'll kind of see too. The big thing, the weakest part of the film for me, it's Franco.
I would say James Franco, yeah. It's Franco. He's not quite leading man material.
He's never been leading man, and he still does a lot of that squinty, smiley stuff, and I can't stand.
Right.
And this part's not his fault, but there's a lot of ADR lines from Franco, you know, like throughout the movie. There's like an ADR line about this, and there's an ADR line about, oh, we need to take the bridge and get across town. And it's like he's just not a leading man, and I just really would have liked to have seen someone that kind of fit the role of Will a little bit better, someone that could have kind of played that kind of someone that you could believe could be a sophisticated scientist.
Right.
I can't buy James Franco as a sophisticated scientist.
I get you.
Even though he does tout his learned abilities and his teaching at NYU and all that bullshit he used to talk about. Yeah, I just don't buy him in the role as much as I would of somebody else. Like, I don't know, let me pick somebody else. Eric Bana.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Like Eric Bana.
Like Eric Bana. Put Eric Bana.
Put Eric Bana
yeah,
in
here. Somebody re-edit this film with Eric Bana. I'm sure you could use scenes from 2003 Hulk and just fit him in. He was a scientist in that, right?
My father's better.
I got egg on my liver.
Yeah. We've lost you guys. And Cody got
Let's not talk about 2003 Angley Hulk anymore. But yeah, he's definitely like the weakest part of the film for me. And like, does it ruin the film? No. Could it have been better? Yes.
Yeah.
If you had a different actor in the lead role, John Lithgow does a great job.
He does.
The supporting characters here, you know, the guy plays Jacobs, all those stuff is, you know, all that's really solid. The supporting cast is really solid, but I think you just needed a little bit of different leading man. And you would have had yourself probably, you know, got yourself another point or two higher for me in my book. I got some dirty eight bips for you, Todd.
Let's do it. Dirty eight bips.
I said bips.
Bips. Bips. Bits.
Got some dirty eight bits for you here, Todd. Or bips, whatever you prefer.
Whatever you like.
Bips or bits, that's what we'll call it. So this is one of the first movies to use motion capture in an on-location setting. Previously, motion capture was limited to special studio setup with special motion capture cameras and very clearly defined surroundings. There's a point in the film where Bright Eyes is giving her fizzy drink. Remember that?
Oh, yeah.
It's in a Gatorade bottle because during the research for the film, director Rupert Wyatt learned that captive chimpanzees love sugar and Gatorade is one of their favorite drinks.
Nice.
Andy Serkis based Caesar's behavior on a chimpanzee named Oliver for the balance of behaving like a civilized chimp. His red shirt and black pants, his appearance, his ability to sign well are based on other chimpanzees in science. One in particular, Niam Chimpinski. Chimpski.
Okay.
I can't. Niam Chimpski. I think that's how you say it.
That's a nice bip.
That's a bip. You like my Niam Chimpski bip?
I like it.
The doors to the cages of the ape facility were removed for all performance capture shots because it was difficult to animate through them. The apes were then animated into the scene, and digital doors and mesh were inserted over them. The climax of the Golden Gate Bridge, I mentioned this before, it was shot on a 400-foot set, which was a world record at the time of production. Koba was the nickname of Joseph Stalin during his time as a revolutionary in Georgia.
Wow.
It was taken by Stalin based on the book The Patricide by a Georgian author, Alexander Casbigul.
Okay.
That's another bip.
That's a heck of a bip.
That's a heck of a bip there.
It's a bip twister.
We talked about the origin of Maurice's name. Last bip I got here for you, Todd. This is Charlton Heston's fifth appearance in the Planet of the Apes films franchise. He starred in the Planet of the Apes 1968, played a smaller role in Beneath the Planet of the Apes 1970, was seen in archive footage kissing Zira in a sepia yellow flashback in Escape from Planet of the Apes 1971. Had a cameo as Zealous in Tim Burton's Planet of the Apes 2001 and can be seen on television set in the movie In the Ape Bunkhouse, playing Michelangelo from The Agony and the Ecstasy 1965 in this film.
Oh, okay.
I don't know if you caught him on the TV there.
I didn't catch that.
But he was there, Todd, in spirit. And I guess, too, there's like some of the background sometimes, like on news and stuff, is like of that Mars like rocket or shuttle launch. I'm assuming that's like setting up, that's probably like Heston's rocket and all that, right? Because they say at one point there's a little throwaway line off screen about it being lost and they can't find it.
Oh, yeah, that's
so
right.
I think that must be kind of a setup.
Little or like Easter egg
a little
for
Easter
that.
Egg to the 1968 Planet of the Apes.
Okay.
Anything else before we go to reviews?
I think I'm good.
All right, we rank films on a 1 to 10 scale, starting from 1 to ranks are torture, 2 awful, 3 bad, 4 subpar, 5 mediocre, 6 decent, 7 good, 8 great, 9 amazing, 10 masterpiece. Todd, give us your final thoughts and review score for Rise of the Planet of the Apes.
For me, minor nitpicks and James Franco aside, I still think this is a great film, and I gave it that score. I gave it an 8, which is great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, minor nitpicks. James Franco takes it down just a little bit more for me. Solid visuals, great effects. Andy Serkis kind of at the, again, staying at the peak of his abilities here with the motion capture work. It's a solid outing. I'm a little bit less on it just because of Franco, and I think I'm going to leave myself a little bit of room for some of the sequels here. So I'm going to say Rise of the Planet of the Apes. I gave it a 7 out of 10, which ranks it as good.
Okay.
Todd, tell everyone how they can find us and get in touch with us on social media.
We are at, finally messed up. Towel Capes on YouTube, Twitter, and Instagram. Towel Capes Podcast on Facebook. You can also email us at towelcapespod@gmail.com.
I saw it go out your eyes.
There's a blip for you.
I saw it go out of your brain.
It completely left me, folks.
If you enjoy the show, please consider leaving a like on this video and subscribing to our channel. Popcorn Mumble will return. We want to thank you so much for watching. Until next time, bye, guys.
See y'all.